June 9, 1995, Alma, Arkansas. While attending a Little League baseball game with her mother, 6-year-old Morgan Nick goes off into a nearby field to play with some other kids before she vanishes without a trace. Morgan's friends claim that an unidentified man spoke to her, and since a red pickup truck was seen leaving the scene, it is suspected that this man might have abducted her. Over 2 decades later, a deceased sex offender named Billy Jack Lynx is named as a person of interest, but he has not been conclusively connected to the case, and Morgan remains a missing person. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring a prominent missing children's case, the 1995 disappearance of 6-year-old Morgan Nick. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Chardonnay Brown, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Chardonnay. This is a recurring monthly contest which you've been carrying on for 5 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the disappearance of Morgan Nick is the case that Chardonnay requested I cover when she originally entered this contest because she was growing up in the same region of Arkansas when Morgan's abduction took place, so the story has always hit close to home for her. The case is every parent's worst nightmare, as Morgan's mother took her to a Little League baseball game one night, and even though she only let her daughter out of her sights for a brief window of time in order to allow her to play with some other kids, it seems like an opportunistic predator took advantage of the situation and kidnapped her. While Morgan's friends reported seeing what they described as a quote-unquote creepy man at the scene alongside a red pickup truck, it seems like there were no witnesses to Morgan's actual abduction. Over the past 2 decades, there have been a number of leads in this case, but one of the most promising developments occurred last year when law enforcement publicly named a man named Billy Jack Lynx as a person of interest. Lynx just happened to live in the area at the time Morgan went missing, and he wound up being arrested a few months later for another sex crime involving a young girl. While Lynx died in prison, investigators are still looking for conclusive evidence to connect him to Morgan's case. It's worth noting that the victim's mother, Colleen Nick, started a non-profit organization called the Morgan Nick Foundation in order to help families of other missing children. When this case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, the segment also profiled the 2001 disappearance of a 3-month-old infant named Jacqueline Vasquez and showed Colleen using her role at the foundation to console the child's mother. After 2 decades, Jacqueline has still not been found, so after I'm finished discussing Morgan's case, I'm going to use some time on this episode to discuss what happened to Jacqueline. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved disappearance of Morgan Nick. Our story begins in Arkansas in 1995. Our central figure is 6-year-old Morgan Chantel Nick, who lives in the town of Ozark, located in Franklin County on the southern edge of the Ozark Mountains. Morgan's parents are John and Colleen Nick, and she also has a 3-year-old brother named Logan and a 22-month-old sister named Taryn. At this particular point, John and Colleen have been divorced for 6 months, so John is currently living in Fort Smith. On the evening of Friday, June the 9th, a family friend invited Colleen and Morgan to attend a Little League baseball game where the friend's son would be playing. The game would take place at Wofford Field in Alma, a small town located in Crawford County, approximately 30 miles west of Ozark, which had a population of just under 3,000 people at that time. Colleen and Morgan had never been to Alma before, so they decided to travel there for what they described as a quote-unquote girls' night out, and spent most of the evening watching the game from the field's bleachers. At around 10:30 p.m., two older kids who were aged 10 and 8 asked Morgan if she would like to go catch some fireflies on a large sand pile located about 40 yards away in a field next to the parking lot. Colleen was initially reluctant to let Morgan go over there, but after the kids and their parents assured Colleen that the area was safe, she finally said yes. Morgan gave her mother a hug and a kiss on the cheek before she left, and Colleen would frequently look over and see Morgan playing with the other two kids near the parking lot. Around 15 minutes later, the baseball game came to an end, and the two kids returned to the bleachers, but Morgan was not with them. They told Colleen that they last saw Morgan emptying sand from her shoes next to her family's parked car, a Nissan Stanza, but when Colleen looked over at the vehicle, Morgan was not there. Colleen quickly went over to search in and around the Stanza, but did not see Morgan, and it wasn't long before the other cars started leaving the parking lot, and there was still no sign of her. Alarm bells started going off when Morgan's friends were questioned by one of the baseball coaches, and they mentioned seeing what they described as a quote-unquote creepy man who had been standing next to a red pickup truck with a white camper shell and briefly went over to speak with them and Morgan. By this point, no pickup trucks matching this description could be seen in the parking lot, so the coach used his cell phone to call the Alma Police Department, and within 6 minutes, they arrived at the scene to perform a search for Morgan. The two kids said that the man was between 23 to 38 years old, 6 feet tall, and weighed around 180 pounds. He also had black or salt and pepper hair, 3 to 4 days' growth of beard, and a hairy chest. The children said that he wore no shirt or shoes and was dressed only in cut-off blue jean shorts, and he spoke to them on what they described as a quote-unquote hillbilly-type dialect or accent. To this day, investigators have never publicly revealed what this man said to Morgan and her friends in order to help weed out false confessions. The red pickup truck was described as possibly being a Ford brand with a dull paint job, a short wheelbase, and curtains over the windows. The white camper shell also appeared to be between 4 to 5 inches shorter than the truck, and possibly damaged, and there was also a gap between the camper and the truck's cab. Over the next several weeks, a massive search effort for Morgan took place, which not only involved the Alma Police Department, but the Arkansas State Police and the FBI. It was estimated that around 300 people attended the baseball game that night, and while most of them were interviewed by law enforcement, none of them could recall having seen Morgan get abducted by anyone. It would soon come to light that a pair of similar abduction attempts involving two other girls had occurred in the area both before and after Morgan went missing. Now, I've recently come across information that at least one of these abduction attempts has no connection to Morgan's case, and I'll be discussing that later on in this episode, but here's what's been reported. On the morning of June the 9th, several hours before Morgan's disappearance, a man driving a red pickup truck attempted to abduct a 4-year-old girl outside a laundromat in Alma, but when the girl started screaming, her mother intervened and the man drove off. The following evening, on June the 10th, a man attempted to entice a 9-year-old girl into the men's restroom at a convenience store in Fort Smith, located 15 miles outside of Alma. The girl refused to go along with it, and the man took off, but investigators initially believed that he was the same man who made the abduction attempt outside the laundromat. He also happened to match the description of the man seen at the baseball field prior to Morgan's disappearance, and the fact that he also drove a red pickup truck seemed to be a compelling connection. Since Colleen wanted to remain in Alma while the search effort was taking place, she wound up spending 6 weeks staying at the town's volunteer fire station, which was located next to the police station. Years later, Colleen and her two other children would make the permanent move to Alma, though she kept the same phone number, on the off chance that Morgan ever tried to contact her. And in spite of Colleen's divorce from Morgan's father, John, he was cleared as a suspect in her disappearance. Colleen successfully lobbied the media to turn Morgan's disappearance into a national news story, and she soon found herself being contacted by other parents whose children had gone missing. So in 1996, 1 year after her daughter vanished, Colleen decided to start the Morgan Nick Foundation, a nonprofit organization designed to assist parents of missing children through intervention, education, and legislation. That same year, another horrific crime involving a child took place when 9-year-old Amber Hagerman was abducted and murdered in Arlington, Texas on January the 15th. As you probably know, even though this crime remains unsolved to this day, it led to the creation of the Amber Alert system to immediately notify the public about child abductions. When the system was implemented in Arkansas, it would be named the Morgan Nick Amber Alert in tribute to her. Morgan's case would be featured on a number of TV shows, including The Oprah Winfrey Show, America's Most Wanted, and Unsolved Mysteries, and of course, I'll be discussing the Unsolved Mysteries segment in more detail later on in this episode. It's also worth noting that in 2005, Morgan's story received additional exposure on an episode of the reality series Extreme Makeover Home Edition, after the Nick family's house was seriously damaged by a water heater explosion, and they wound up getting it remodeled on the show. As the years went on, the authorities would perform a number of searches in relation to Morgan's case. One of them took place in January of 2002 on a private piece of land in Logan County, located just outside the town of Boonville, which is about 50 miles southeast of Alma. The authorities claimed they had received a tip that Morgan's remains were buried on the property, and the details provided were, quote-unquote, so specific that they felt it was necessary to perform a dig with a backhoe and use a cadaver dog. But in the end, the search turned up nothing. In November of 2010, federal investigators performed a search of a vacant house in the small town of Spira, Oklahoma, located over 30 miles southwest of Alma, near the Arkansas-Oklahoma state line. The residence had once belonged to a man who was currently serving time in the Oklahoma State Penitentiary for rape and child molestation, but even though the authorities were hoping to uncover DNA evidence to prove that Morgan had once been inside the house, they found nothing. 7 years later, in December of 2017, another search effort was performed there involving the local police, the FBI, and the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation. They were apparently acting on a tip involving a case which was completely unrelated to Morgan's, but this time, they were able to perform a search of the entire property instead of just the house. Cadaver dogs alerted investigators to a well on the property, but once again, the search effort failed to turn up any evidence. Another odd development occurred in June of 2012, when VitalCheck, an internet-based company which supplies certified copies of vital documents, received an order from someone identifying herself as Morgan Chantel Nick, who was hoping to obtain a copy of her birth certificate. Weeks later, the Arkansas State Police tracked down Tanya Renee Smith, a convicted felon living in Hollister, Missouri, and arrested her on the charge of felony computer fraud. It turned out that Smith had been attempting to steal Morgan's identity, but investigators ultimately concluded that Smith had no involvement in her disappearance. After pleading guilty to the felony computer fraud charge, Smith received a sentence of 6 years probation and a $2,500 fine. In April of 2021, a new documentary about this case titled Still Missing Morgan aired on the Little Rock TV station THV11 and revealed some new information which had never been made public before. The biggest revelation was that a witness who had been filming the baseball game at Wofford Field on the night Morgan disappeared managed to capture footage of a red pickup truck with a white camper shell, which matched the description of the truck that Morgan's friends had seen. While the truck's driver could not be seen in any of the footage, this marked the first time an image of the truck had ever been released to the public. As a result of the documentary's airing, the Alma Police Department wound up receiving hundreds of new leads, many of which they had never heard before. But the biggest new development occurred in November of that year, when the authorities publicly named a person of interest for the first time. The individual in question was a convicted sex offender named Billy Jack Lynx, who had once lived in the town of Van Buren, only about 8 miles from the location where Morgan went missing. In 1992, Lynx was charged with sexually abusing a young girl, and after entering a plea of no contest, he wound up receiving a suspended sentence and was forced to undergo counseling. On August 29, 1995, just over 2 months after Morgan's disappearance, Lynx showed up at a Sonic drive-in restaurant in Van Buren while driving a red 1986 Chevrolet Scottsdale pickup truck. Lynx, who appeared to be visibly intoxicated, drove up near an 11-year-old girl and pulled out some money. After making some sexual comments, Lynx offered to pay the girl to hop inside his truck and accompany him to his house, but she responded by screaming and running away. Lynx then proceeded to flee the scene and struck a utility pole in the process, but an eyewitness was able to catch his license number and provided it to the police. The following day, Lynx was tracked down to his residence and arrested, and he would later be convicted on the charge of sexual indecency with a child and received a 6-year prison sentence. When investigators performed a search of Lynx's pickup truck, they found a number of items of interest, including duct tape, a machete, a tarp, and a rope. They also uncovered hair and fiber evidence, as well as traces of blood on one of the seats. Since Lynx's truck matched the description of the red truck seen at Wofford Field, the authorities looked at him as a potential suspect in Morgan's case, particularly after one of Lynx's neighbors told them that they had recalled seeing a camper shell on his truck until a few months before his arrest. However, when the Arkansas State Police and the FBI attempted to interview Lynx about Morgan's case, he refused to speak with them and lawyered up. Before he could finish serving his sentence on the sexual indecency charge, Lynx passed away behind bars at the age of 75 in the year 2000. Investigators said they finally decided to publicly name Lynx as a person of interest because they believe that the evidence they had gathered points towards him. But even though a recent push has been made to perform DNA testing on the blood and hair evidence collected from Lynx's truck, it's unknown if this evidence still exists. The Alma Police Department and the Arkansas State Crime Lab have both confirmed that they do not have the evidence in their possession, and when the FBI was asked if they had it, they simply replied, quote, "No comment." For now, the authorities are attempting to learn everything they can about Lynx's background and hope that anyone who might have information about him will come forward. Thus far, they know that Lynx was born in Crawford County, served in the U.S. Army during World War II, and was employed by Braniff International Airways in Dallas, Texas from 1962 until 1974. Sometime after leaving this job, he moved to Van Buren, Arkansas, and he may also have additional ties to Tennessee and Oklahoma. While Lynx continues to remain a person of interest, thus far, no conclusive evidence has connected him to Morgan Nick's disappearance, and after 27 years, she has still not been found. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, having a child go missing is every parent's worst nightmare, but it's particularly devastating if their disappearance takes place during a narrow window of time when they happen to take their eyes off their child. Even if the parent was not at fault at all, these situations leave them constantly questioning what they should have done differently. Morgan Nick's disappearance is very reminiscent of a Canadian missing children's case I covered on episode number 86 of this podcast, and that's the disappearance of 4-year-old Michael Dunahy, which took place in Victoria, British Columbia in 1991. Much like Morgan's case, Michael's parents took him to a local sporting event, and he asked them if they could go off to play in a playground located right next to the parking lot. Even though the Dunahys only took their eyes off Michael for a few minutes, it seems apparent that an opportunistic predator took advantage of the situation in order to abduct him and flee the scene undetected. Michael's mother would later say that even though her instincts told her that something wasn't right, she still gave Michael permission to go to the playground and has regretted that decision ever since. Likewise, Colleen Nick said that she didn't feel comfortable letting Morgan out of her sight but after being assured that the area was safe, she let her daughter go off and play. Given that Morgan was with two other kids, and there were around 300 people at Wofford Field at that time, you wouldn't think that someone would be able to abduct Morgan and flee the area without anyone seeing anything, but appears that's exactly what happened. I do not believe that Colleen, Nick, or Michael Dunhee's parents deserve any criticism they might have received for allowing their children out of their sights for a brief window of time, because in the vast majority of these situations, nothing bad will ever happen. But unfortunately for Morgan and Michael, this was one of those one-in-a-million scenarios where they crossed paths with an evil monster who was incredibly brazen and also incredibly lucky that they managed to get away with it. However, while Michael's abduction took place completely under the radar and without witnesses seeing a suspect or a vehicle, Morgan's disappearance at least has the description of an unidentified man and a red pickup truck to work with. This story has received a lot of attention over the past year because for the first time, the authorities have publicly named a person of interest, Billy Jack Lynx, even though he has been deceased for the past 2 decades. If you do any online searches about the case, you're going to come across a lot of rumors about potential suspects on message boards and social media, where people have left comments and named individuals whom they believe are Morgan's abductor. However, because these rumors are unsubstantiated, I won't be discussing them here, and will instead put all my focus on Billy Jack Lynx, since he is the only person who has ever been named by law enforcement. While Lynx happened to own a red pickup truck at the time Morgan went missing, the obvious issue with him is that he does not match the description of the creepy-looking man who was seen at Wofford Field. Morgan's friends described him as being between 23 to 30 years old, whereas Billy Jack Lynx would have been in his early 70s. The only photograph of Lynx that you'll find online is a mugshot which shows him having a gray beard, bald and gray hair, and large thick eyeglasses, which the creepy man was not described as wearing. Yes, Morgan's friends were kids, and you could argue that their descriptions might not be 100% reliable, but I seriously doubt that they're going to confuse a guy in his 20s or 30s with an elderly man in his 70s. However, I'm sure that law enforcement is well aware of this discrepancy, and would not have publicly named Lynx as a person of interest if they didn't have good reason to believe he might be involved. Investigators stated that evidence they have gathered points towards Lynx, though they do not yet have a smoking gun to prove he was the perpetrator. It sounds like Lynx was looked at as a potential suspect after he was arrested for another sex crime in the months following Morgan's disappearance, but why did they wait until 2021 in order to name him? Well, I get the impression this might have something to do with the release of the Still Missing Morgan documentary, as it has led to law enforcement receiving hundreds of new leads, and it's possible that this included new evidence which pointed to Lynx. After all, this documentary marked the first public release of home video footage of a red pickup truck with a white camper shell that was seen parked at Wofford Field that night, so perhaps this helped jog someone's memory. While the documentary aired on Arkansas television last April, I have still not had the opportunity to watch it. It was announced that there were plans to release the documentary as a 4-part series on a streaming platform, but this has yet to take place. However, if you go to the documentary's official website at stillmissingmorgan.com, it reads, quote, coming fall 2022, so for all we know, maybe the series will drop shortly after the release of this podcast episode. I definitely hope it receives widespread exposure, as all these recent developments suggest that investigators are looking for that one final lead which might finally help them solve this case. But I do have to add the disclaimer that we still can't be 100% certain that the creepy man seen at Wofford Field or the red pickup truck are connected to Morgan's disappearance. In fact, even though the man was seen standing next to the pickup truck, it does not sound like he was ever seen inside it, so for all we know, the truck may not have even belonged to him. I do acknowledge the possibility that even though this unidentified man may have existed and said something unsettling to Morgan and her friends, he may not have been the person who actually committed the abduction. Perhaps someone else, such as Billy Jack Lynx, could have grabbed Morgan a short time after she interacted with the other man. If you do a Google image search for Morgan Nix abductor, you might experience some confusion as you'll come across two separate composite sketches of the suspect. The most commonly shared sketch, which has also been featured on Morgan's Missing poster, showcases a man with about 3 to 4 days' growth of beard, and it matches the description provided by Morgan's two friends. However, the second sketch features a man with a much thicker beard and thicker eyebrows, who looks quite different than the man in the other sketch. So how do we explain this discrepancy? Well, the sketch of the man with the thicker beard was originally circulated back in 1995, but it was not until January of 2001 when the second sketch was released, and law enforcement pretty much told everyone to disregard the first sketch. You see, it turned out that the first sketch was based on the description of the man driving a red pickup truck who attempted to abduct a 4-year-old girl from a laundromat in Alma on the morning of June the 9th, several hours before Morgan went missing. At the time, investigators had good reason to believe that this was the same man who kidnapped Morgan, as it makes sense that after failing to abduct a young girl that morning, he would attempt to do so again in the same town later that evening. However, even though many of the sources still make mention of the attempted laundromat abduction, it has apparently been ruled out as having any connection to Morgan's case. If you go to the Web Sleuths forum, you'll find a number of old comments there from around 2009 by a poster under the username Josh Rima, who shared some email correspondence they had with Colleen Nick, as well as a representative from the Morgan Nick Foundation. They claim that there has always been misinformation out there about Morgan's case, particularly in regards to the abduction attempt from the laundromat on the morning of June the 9th. It appears that investigators eventually learned that the whole incident was a custody dispute, and that the man driving the pickup truck was the girl's father, and he was trying to steal his daughter away from her mother while she was doing laundry. So even though the incident likely had nothing to do with Morgan's disappearance, the original composite sketch was based on the description of the man from the laundromat, not the man seen at the baseball field. And for whatever reason, it took 5.5 years for law enforcement to remedy this and release a new sketch. If this is true, then it sounds like the abduction attempt from the laundromat was nothing more than an unfortunate coincidence, as I'm sure there were multiple men who drove red pickup trucks in Arkansas back in 1995. Now, investigators originally expressed their belief that the guy from the laundromat was the same man who attempted to lure another girl into a convenience store restroom in Fort Smith on June the 10th. But if the first incident was nothing more than a custody dispute involving a father and his own daughter, then I'm not sure he would have gone after another girl in another town one day later. It does not sound like the man from the convenience store was linked to a red pickup truck, so for all we know, this could be yet another completely unrelated incident which has nothing to do with Morgan's case. Either way, when you learn about this discrepancy with the composite sketches, it makes you wonder just how reliable this lead involving the creepy bearded man really is, and could help explain why all the focus now seems to be on an elderly individual like Billy Jack Lynx. While it's possible that law enforcement is withholding this information from the public, I would be curious to know if there were any witnesses who recalled seeing a man matching Lynx's description at Wofford Field that night. It's worth noting that since the two kids Morgan had been playing with are now grown up, they've started giving public interviews in recent years in order to recount their experience. But it's not clear if they've ever been asked to identify Lynx or remember seeing him. But before we talk more about Lynx, I want to make mention of the two searches that were performed of a house and its surrounding property in Spira, Oklahoma, in both 2010 and 2017. It was reported that the original owner was serving time in prison for rape and child molestation, and while his identity has never been released publicly, investigators did clarify that he was still in prison at the time the searches were performed. Since Lynx died in 2000, they obviously weren't referring to him, and he was living in Van Buren, Arkansas at the time of his arrest. So if Lynx was the perpetrator, then the search of this house in Spiro is probably nothing more than a dead end. Over the past year, investigators have been trying to gather as much information as they can about Lynx's background. We know he was arrested for at least 2 other sexual offenses against children during the 1990s, but it's hard to imagine a man suddenly doing this for the first time while he's in his late 60s or early 70s without having a prior history of this behavior. In retrospect, it's pretty outrageous that Lynx was charged with sexually abusing a child in 1992 and only received a suspended sentence because if he is responsible for Morgan's disappearance, that he should have been locked up and never even gotten the opportunity to harm her to begin with. We know that Van Buren is only 8 miles from Alma, so if Lynx wanted to abduct a child, then it makes sense that he might decide to travel to another town besides the one where he lived. Lynx also drove a red pickup truck, and it's very interesting how one of his neighbors seemed to recall the truck having a camper shell until a few months before Lynx was arrested in August of 1995. The detail about the camper shell was shared throughout all the media outlets in the Arkansas area, so I could definitely see Lynx deciding to get rid of it in hopes that the investigation wouldn't lead to him. We know that the FBI attempted to interview Lynx about Morgan's case, and he refused to speak with them, but I have to wonder if one of the reasons he was not pursued harder as a potential suspect at that time was because of the age discrepancy. There was so much focus on the perpetrator being a man in his 20s or 30s that investigators may have written off the possibility of a 70-year-old committing this crime, but that outlook has obviously changed in recent years. While Lynx is no longer with us, genetic genealogy has become a complete game changer in cold case investigations, as it can link DNA evidence to deceased suspects and allow these older cases to be conclusively solved, even though the perpetrator can no longer be charged with the crime. Of course, the big complication in this case is that Morgan's body has never been found, so there's no crime scene, though there was blood and hair evidence collected from Lynx's pickup truck when he was arrested. If DNA testing can be performed on this evidence and it matches Morgan, then that would pretty much prove that Lynx was the perpetrator, since there's no innocent explanation for Morgan's DNA being inside his truck. But frustratingly, it's unclear if any of this physical evidence still exists, as it seems like the authorities have been unable to find it. As you can imagine, this is quite infuriating, but since DNA profile was still a relatively new tool in criminal investigations back in 1995, and Lynx was not considered to be a serious suspect at the time, law enforcement may not have believed that this blood and hair evidence would have any relevance to Morgan's case. But here we are 27 years later, and we still do not have the victim's body, and the primary person of interest has been deceased for 2 decades, so DNA testing may be the only option we have to solve this case. After Morgan's abduction took place, investigators at least had the wherewithal to collect a number of items which had been left behind at Wofford Field, such as cigarette butts and empty bottles, on the chance that they contain the perpetrator's DNA. I'm hoping these items are still being preserved as evidence after all this time, because even though they probably have no relevance to this case, it would be interesting if testing turned up traces of Lynx's DNA on any of them. This wouldn't conclusively prove that he abducted Morgan, but it would place him at the field that night, even though he lived in a completely different town. The fact of the matter is that this case has had very few leads to work with for so many years, so I think it's a pretty big deal that Lynx was publicly named as a person of interest after all this time. We obviously don't have all the facts about why the authorities did this, but from what I've seen, there does seem to be a compelling circumstantial case against him. If the authorities don't have the necessary physical evidence to prove Lynx's involvement, then perhaps it will take the right person coming forward with information. After all, even if DNA connected Lynx to the crime, it may not offer much comfort to the Nick family unless they can also recover her remains. Hopefully, the Still Missing Morgan documentary gets a wide release, and possibly leads to that one final push which is necessary to solve this case. Anyway, I previously mentioned that Colleen Nick has taken her own unthinkable tragedy and used it as a springboard to start the Morgan Nick Foundation, which has been a valuable resource to help families of missing children for the past 26 years. When Morgan's story was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in August of 2001, the segment also profiled another missing children's place which took place in Arizona, and Colleen was shown traveling there in order to console the child's mother. Since this case also continues to remain unsolved after all these years, I'm going to talk about it in more detail right now. The victim was a 3.5-month-old infant named Jacqueline Vasquez, who lived in Phoenix with her 21-year-old father, Jorge Vasquez, and her 18-year-old mother, Elizabeth Castaneda. On May 6, 2001, Olivia took Jacqueline and her other daughter, 2-year-old Nayeli, to the adjacent town of Avondale in order to attend a swap meet located on 123rd Street and Buckeye Road. They were dropped off there by Jorge at 11:15 a.m., and Olivia was planning to meet up with her mother, Maria Castaneda, who had her own booth at the swap meet. However, shortly after they arrived, Nayeli needed to use the bathroom, so Olivia took her to a porta potty. Jacqueline was being carried around in a car seat, but Olivia realized that she could not fit both of her children inside the porta potty. So Olivia made the decision to leave Jacqueline's car seat outside while she and Nayeli used the bathroom. But even though they were only inside the porta potty for about a minute or two, Olivia emerged to discover that Jacqueline and her car seat were gone. Olivia initially hoped that her mother had taken the child and ran to Maria's booth at the swap meet, but Jacqueline was not there. For the next 20 minutes, Olivia and Maria frantically searched the entire swap meet for Jacqueline, but when they could not find her, they contacted the Avondale Police Department in order to report Jacqueline missing. After the police arrived, they immediately sealed off the swap meet to search every single vehicle and individual that left, but they turned up no trace of Jacqueline. However, the police did speak to a vendor who had brought her own infant daughter to the swap meet and had her sitting in a car seat at her booth. The vendor claimed that around the time Jacqueline went missing, a woman whom she described as quote-unquote suspicious had come up to her booth and started caressing her daughter's cheek while saying, quote, "What a beautiful baby." Indeed, other witnesses from the swap meet would share similar stories about a woman who was frequently asking about the children and infants who were in attendance and appeared to be giving them undue attention. She was described as appearing to be in her 30s and possibly being Hispanic, and one witness recalled seeing her linger around the portable toilets shortly before Olivia took her two children there. Since investigators were unable to find anyone at the swap meet who matched the woman's description, it was theorized that she may have noticed Jacqueline lying unattended in her car seat outside the porta potty and decided to abduct her and flee the scene before the police arrived. Even though a composite sketch was created for the woman and publicly circulated, she was never identified. In a parallel to the home video footage of the red pickup truck in the Morgan Nick case, it turned out that a local TV cameraman had been filming footage of the swap meet and just happened to capture a woman matching this description as she was leaving with an infant. It was initially suspected that Jacqueline's abduction had been filmed, but investigators soon tracked this woman down. They determined that the infant she had been carrying was not Jacqueline, and the woman had no involvement in her disappearance. In yet another parallel to the Morgan Nick case, it's been reported that the authorities were looking for a red, full-size pickup truck, which was seen near the swap meet around the time period Jacqueline went missing, and may have been a Ford, but it's never been established if the truck had any connection to this case. Investigators quickly ruled out Olivia, Jorge, and everyone else from their families as suspects, as they were certain that Jacqueline was the victim of a stranger abduction, possibly by someone who wanted a child of their own to raise. Olivia and Jorge would separate in 2003, before Olivia moved to California, and she also went on to have a baby son named Jesus. Sadly, Jacqueline Vasquez has still not been found, but her most distinctive characteristic is a unique heart-shaped birthmark on her upper right arm. If she is still alive today, she would be 21 years old and may be completely unaware that she was stolen from her birth family and is now living under a false identity. So this is yet another case where a parent only took their eyes off their child for a few minutes, yet the absolute worst thing happened to them within a very narrow window of time. Not surprisingly, if you look up online discussions about this case, you're going to see a lot of unjust victim blaming directed towards Olivia Castañeda for leaving her infant daughter unattended while she used the porta potty. But from what I've seen from Olivia's interviews, no one regrets that decision more than she does, and you can tell it eats away at her every day. In the vast majority of these situations, nothing bad would ever happen, so it's just rotten luck that someone managed to abduct Jacqueline from a public place and get away without anyone seeing anything. You might be inclined to speculate that Jacqueline's abduction might be a convenient cover story concocted by Olivia because she was personally responsible for her daughter's disappearance, but investigators completely ruled out that possibility and are certain that Olivia is telling the truth about what happened. Her story seems to be supported by all the independent eyewitness accounts of a suspicious-looking woman who was behaving strangely around numerous children at the swap meet, almost as if she was scouting them for an abduction. It's possible that this woman went there for the sole purpose of kidnapping a child, and when she saw Jacqueline lying unattended next to the portable toilet, she took advantage of the situation. I'm definitely inclined to agree with the theory that the abductor might have been a woman who lost a child or couldn't have children, so they decided to grab an infant in order to raise as their very own. While these situations are incredibly tragic for both the abductees and their families, the silver lining is that people don't often kidnap babies with the intention of murdering them, so there is a decent chance that Jacqueline is still alive out there somewhere under a new identity with no inkling of who she really is. During the past few decades, we've seen a number of stories about infants who were abducted during the 1980s or 1990s, such as Carlina White and Kamaya Mobley, that were found to be alive years later. In these aforementioned cases, the child was raised by their kidnapper, who passed themselves off as their biological parent. This facade often winds up cracking once the child reaches an age in which they require important documentation, such as their birth certificate or social security card, and then discovers that their so-called parent doesn't have them. If things reach the point where they start believing they might be a missing child, DNA testing can be used to confirm their identity. At the time of this recording, Jacqueline Vasquez is 4 months shy of her 22nd birthday, so she's reached the age in which an abducted child living under a false identity might start questioning their background. And one reason this particular case might be solvable is because Jacqueline had a distinct heart-shaped birthmark on her upper right arm. If there are any young women out there with a similar birthmark who have started questioning their own identity and decide to browse missing children's websites on the internet, then perhaps they might come across Jacqueline Vasquez's profile someday and put two and two together. At this particular point in time, Olivia Castagnetta would only be about 40 years old, so while losing 2 decades with her daughter is still a terrible tragedy, there's always a chance they could reunite and still have a fulfilling life together. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Jacqueline Vasquez, or you believe you might be Jacqueline, please contact the Avondale Police Department at 623-333-7001. That's 623-333-7001. And if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Morgan Nick, please contact either the FBI, the Arkansas State Police, or the Alma Police Department at 479-632-3333. That's 479-632-3333. You can also send in a tip through the Still Missing Morgan website at stillmissingmorgan.com. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Chardonnay Brown for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode in which I did something a little different from the norm and listed my top 10 favorite movies that were based on true crimes. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1986 murder of Chaim Weiss. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.